Hello, Lorena Allen with you for Hindsight on RN. Today we're marking NAIDOC, the annual national week-long celebration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, to bring you a story about justice and justice miscarried. It's the story of Dakia Wirrupanda, a clan leader from Arnhem Land who was tried for murder in 1934. His trial, Dakia versus the King, has become a landmark case in Australian legal history. In our feature today, producer Tom Murray travels to Blue Mud Bay in northeastern Arnhem Land, the Yilpra homelands. This story has been told before, but when Tom produced this program some years ago, it was the first time that Dakia's family had spoken publicly about their attempts to find resolution to the events which took place more than seven decades earlier. In this feature, you'll hear from a number of Dakia's relatives, including his son, Dakia Wirrupanda, speaking from his Yilpra home.
Our leader made a show of himself openly to the world that he killed a man. Your leader did not make a show of you openly to us.
I am the first Australia that era.
Here was Takir, a real Australian, fighting for his people and for his land and for his family, and standing against white Australian Westminster law, a law that came from England. And here was one old man, leader, who was fighting for his own land and his own people and his own tribe. And yet we do not know what really happened to him.
Silence or stand.
Gentlemen of the jury, the accused Takia at the bar stands charged with murder. The particulars are that on the first day of August 1933, at Woodar Island, he did kill and murder one Albert Stewart McColl, a constable of police, by spearing. And upon this he has been arraigned, and upon his arraignment has pleaded not guilty, and has put himself upon his country, which country you are. Your charge, therefore, is to inquire as to whether he is guilty or not guilty, and to hearken to the evidence.
Takia was a leader, very strong leader. He was a leader that people from other clans respected him. They respected him because they loved him. They respected him because he makes good and gentle laws. I started painting some of his paintings and all his footprints and all his lands and all his songs and all that. I thought to represent him that he was a very strong man, strong leader, and he was a very kind and gentle leader, as he was traveling with his warriors. He walked with them, lived with them, make business with them together, men business and through death business. we know he was doing the right thing for the people. He did a great job in the past when he was with the community, with the other land owners.
Melbourne Herald, 4th of August. Jungle spearing. Black on trial for constable's death. Darwin, Friday. The ambushing and spearing by blacks of Constable McCall of Wooda Island on August the 1st last year was again detailed in Darwin today at the trial of the Aboriginal Takiyar on a charge of having murdered McCall. Takiyar has pleaded not guilty and was defended by Mr. W.J.P. Fitzgerald. Members of the police expedition told how McCall had been speared through the chest when left with black trackers and another constable to guard a jungle camp. Constable V.C. Hall, giving the first of the police evidence, said two trackers had been left with Constable McCall at Wooda Island in charge of a camp. He said that police had landed on Wooda Island to search for and question Aborigines in connection with the killing of five Japanese at Caledon Bay the previous year. The party captured and handcuffed five Luberas on the island, questioned them, and then stopped at an Aboriginal camp for lunch. After lunch, one of the trackers rushed in and said that a big mob of blackfellas was coming. The Luberas were released and left in the charge of Constable McCall. Constable Hall, Maury and Marney went to intercept the men. The party then separated. Constable Hall fired several shots. When they reached the camp, McCall and the Luberas were missing. Taking up the search, they found McCall's body at the edge of the jungle, a quarter of a mile from the camp. A blood-stained spear and McCall's revolver were found near the body. To Judge Wells, Hall said that the police party was expecting an attack from the Aborigines on the beach. The hearing is not finished.
That was a 1933, something like that. Yeah. And I was myself was there. And I'm still remembering all the tie-up of what happened at Wooda Island. And I was still remember that I was playing around with the other boys and the girls. And I saw that first white man I saw there is a policeman. They said, "Hey, Konyara, Konyara, this is a white man name." After that, been tied up, they've been shooting first in the hair by rifle. And that girl's wife, she was calling a name, "That girl, where are you? Where are you?" And then straight away killed right in there. I still remember that that time. And the policeman was just run down and pulled over.
Gawarin Gumana is a senior elder of the Dalwangu clan and is speaking from his homeland at Gangan. He is the only living witness to the killing of Constable McCall. Ted Egan has followed the story of Takiyar for almost 50 years. His book, Justice All Their Own, is the definitive text on the case.
It must be kept in mind that there were three killings. The first was the killing of five Japanese at Caledon Bay by a group that are today called the Japu. In those days, the leader of the Japu people was a man named Wangu. And Wangu had been insulted for whatever reason by the Japanese who had come there to harvest tripang. And Wangu, again certain of his rights in his own community, said that in retribution for the insult on himself, that his sons should kill the Japanese. And the next morning his sons duly did that. They walked down the beach and killed five Japanese. That was at Caledon Bay. And that was September 1932. In March 1933, two white men, Trainer and Fagan, were killed at Wooda Island by two other Yolngu named Takiyar and Marera.
I took Fagan and Trainer from Milangimbi to Arnhem Bay, and they set sail after leaving me at Arnhem Bay and went on round the coast, and they got killed, you see. I told Fagan and Trainer to be very careful of the people, and they didn't interfere with any women or anything until they got down to Wooda Island. When they got to Wooda Island, they got women on their boat, and then they got them on their boat and didn't want to hand them back to the natives. And Merera and Takiyar came on board and killed them. They had a big fight on the boat, and the two white men lost.
When the police eventually in 1933, July 1933, came to Northeast Arnhem Land to investigate the killings of the Japanese, they were proceeding, in police language, proceeding northwards along the coastline with horses to attempt to find out who had killed the Japanese. Along the way, for whatever reason, Big Pat, the police tracker assigned to them from Roper Bar, saw smoke on Wooder Island and suggested that the police party should go onto Wooder Island to investigate. Now, you're 100 miles away from the scene of the crime, and Takiya had little or no connection with Wangu. In fact, it's widely believed that he and Wangu had a long-standing dispute. So there's no connection between Takiya and Marrera and the killings of the Japanese. And one of the big mysteries is why the police then proceeded to leave all their horses unguarded on the mainland and pile onto a very unsafe little boat and all go to Wooder Island. Now, there's much more in this than meets my eye, and it was certainly Big Pat who instigated the trip to Wooder Island.
The police came into a hornet's nest when they arrived on Wooder Island. They did not know that Fagan and Traynor had been killed. And the police rounded up some natives there, or rather they came across a camp. The men all ran away, but they left the women. And the natives' account is the women were all handcuffed together, and one was handcuffed to McColl. This is from my stories from the natives themselves, which I got soon after McColl was killed, you see. I got the first story about the killing, both of Fagan and Traynor and McColl, when I was travelling through from Darwin again, and I was at Elko Island. They told me that McColl had interfered with Japeri, Takiao's wife, and that when he was getting up, and they told me how he was fastening up his trousers, Takiao came on the scene, threw a spear at him, and that was that. I don't think the first spear got him. I think it was about the second spear that got him in the chest. McColl was trying to fire and his revolver didn't work. Whether he was handicapped with still being handcuffed to Japeri or not, I don't know.
Fred Gray first arrived in Arnhem Land in 1932 and was a friend and trading partner to many of the Arnhem Land clan leaders. He was working with the people of Northeast Arnhem Land at the time of the killings and heard many of the stories firsthand.
Ironically, the reason why Takiya and Marrera had killed Traynor and Fagan was that Traynor and Fagan had kidnapped some women, including the same wife, Japeri. And fortunately, I think I'm the only one who ever interviewed Japeri about this, and she's now dead. But her word is that her husband killed the two white men, Traynor and Fagan, and subsequently killed Constable McColl because she was being held prisoner in both cases.
You're with Hindsight on Radio National, where we're hearing the story of Takiya Weerpanda and a landmark legal case from the Northern Territory in 1934.
I take the view that this man, despite the fact that the evidence is very scanty, killed McColl. I think it is quite safe to draw an inference that he killed McColl in a deliberate and cunning way. I am certainly of the opinion that it should not be allowed to go out amongst the Aboriginal population that an Aboriginal can murder a policeman and get away with a few years' imprisonment. The white population seems to be impressed with this fact. I cannot find any reason at all for doing other than pronounce sentence of death. The Sydney Morning Herald, Tuesday, August 7th, 1934. Sentences in North condemned. Demand for release as government asked to recall Judge Wells. An emphatic protest against the passing of the death sentence upon Aborigines in Northern Australia was made at a meeting in Sydney last night. Takia, the Culloden Bay Aboriginal, found guilty of murdering Constable McCall, was sentenced to death by Judge Wells in Darwin yesterday. A resolution which will be sent to the Prime Minister, Mr. Lyons, and the Minister for the Interior, Mr. Perkins, was agreed to as follows. That this meeting, consisting of workers and citizens of every shade of political thought, urges the federal government to adopt a more humane, scientific and civilised policy towards the original inhabitants of Australia. By the release of all Aborigines, now doing life sentences, are condemned to death in the Northern Territory, whose only crimes have been that they have defended their women. That in future all such cases be tried in the actual ground of the alleged crime, and that the court have the assistance of a competent person who understands the customs and language of the accused, and that all surrounding tribes be called to the court and have the case interpreted to them. That more natural native reserves be proclaimed. That all present at this meeting be urged to do their utmost to raise the standard of morality of the white Australians towards their fellow black Australians.
All right, thank you. My name is Tukal Whitpunda. I am the last son of Zakir Whitpunda. I would like to understand myself that the crown I'm asking for with the symbol of two animals there, kangaroo and emu. Those two animals are part of Irige's very important man business that's been handled in the Ngara side, in the man business side. So I'm asking it, why Crown of Australia, Commonwealth, and missionary worked together, and why they did not support him like he expected their law inside jail, Fernabe. So Takia's heart cried for his people. So he went away carrying heavy worries, burden for his people into the jail. No English, no anything, and they treat him there like a dog. They treat him there like a something, like whoever, who he was. They treated him just like he's got no footprint. They treated him just like he had no knowledge to teach his people. They treated him just like his heart was taking all his people the wrong way. But he wasn't. He wasn't.
It must have been terribly confusing for Takia, the court case. He'd come to Darwin voluntarily, spoke no English whatsoever, and he was he must have been totally bewildered by the proceedings. It might be drawing the long bow a bit to suggest that he'd be anticipating something like the Makarrata ordeal, which is the usual way in Arnhem Land of restoring the peace. If I offend you at a certain time, you can get your relatives to confront me with the details of the alleged offence, and your relatives then throw spears at me, and I just stand out and dodge them, and your relatives come closer and closer, and eventually someone spears me in the leg, in the thigh. And the Arnhem Land word for thigh is makar, and the system of trial by ordeal is called the Makarrata. And Takia was perhaps thinking that for justice to be done, and particularly as he'd volunteered to come to Darwin, that there might be something like that, but instead he was confronted by the ordeal of being put upon, you've been put upon your country, which country you are. And he wouldn't have even known the English word country, but the terms of that addressed to the jury by the judge's associate might have suggested to him, had it been translated, that it was going to be a fair trial by according to the rules of his country.
Naripepea, that's what we call government, Naripepea. In those days, Naripepea, the government, did not recognize Takir, did not know his knowledge, did not know his leadership, did not know anything. They just saw him, he was only a black man. So they took him away and put him somewhere. Even though by his respect to you people, he stayed. He did not run away from the jail. He never broke out and ran away.
Gentlemen of the jury, the accused Takiyar at the bar stands charged with murder. Kill and murder one Albert Stewart McColl. And upon this he has been arraigned, and upon his arraignment has pleaded not guilty, and has put himself upon his country. Which country you are, whether he is guilty or not guilty, and to hearken to the evidence.
The all-white jury would have had virtually no knowledge of the practices of Arnhem Land, and as far as the judge and the jury and the legal counsel, including Takiyar's own legal counsel, were concerned, he was an illiterate savage who represented nothing much. He didn't look very much like their country at all, but he was nonetheless, the procedure was followed whereby he was arraigned, and it's said that he's been arraigned on this charge of spearing, and upon his arraignment has pleaded not guilty and has put himself upon his country, which country you are. I would have think, though, that the jury would have felt they had little or no relationship to this person in the dock. Many of them probably thought he wasn't even a human being.
The anomaly and the injustice of the whole punishment of tribal and other offences for which the people of this territory have been penalised is the fact that they believe that they are still living under their own laws, and they have no reason to recognise the fact that a new regime has taken over their affairs, except that they know vaguely that there is somewhere an individual or a power called the government that sometimes visits vengeance on them. For that is all that the white man's justice has so far meant to the black man of Arnhem Land. The unhappy fact is that he can look back on the tradition established by the Indonesian voyagers and contrast this with the treatment he and his women have received subsequently from the whites. Donald Thompson, University of Melbourne.
From the 1870s, there were a number of prospecting parties that headed east across Arnhem Land from the Pine Creek goldfields. And they'd been told of these stories that circulated around the camps about Portuguese and Spanish having found copious amounts of gold out around Blue Mud Bay and Caledon Bay. And so these prospecting parties would go overland with, you know, 4 or 5 months' worth of supplies, and ultimately ended up shooting their way through Arnhem Land, and particularly through East Arnhem Land, where people hadn't had much contact with white fellas since, say, Matthew Flinders in 1803. There were expeditions that made more progress because people were not attacking them. They were burning out the country around them to restrict feed for their horses and things like that. But the resistance direct on really dropped away because of the massacres that were carried out. Then in the 1890s and up to about 1908, there had two cattle stations that took over Arnhem Land, Arafura and Florida. And Florida was run by the Eastern and African Cold Storage Supply Company. And they moved thousands of head of cattle into that country, up around where Ramengining now is. And on Florida Station, they had a policy of shoot to kill. And so they arranged hunting parties, one of which was led by a white fellow called George Conway, who's now buried in a bunmark grave at Elsie Cemetery. And he basically just got up parties of Queensland blackfellas who'd come across with the cattle, and they would ride out and they would just hunt down the camps, and they'd hit two or three camps a day on these exercises to just wipe out people who were spearing cattle or chasing them into the swamps where they were getting bogged.
Andrew McMillan is the author of An Intruder's Guide to East Arnhem Land, a history of outside contact with the Yolngu landowners of this area. We've just arrived in Gangan, the site of a massacre by one of these hunting parties. It is the home of Takya's mother's clan, the Dawangu.
In the past, when all leaders, Tua and Irija, come together, they enjoyed the way of living. They enjoyed it. They stayed, they listened to each other. They support each other. And then something come and fit into them and start firing gun to a person, to a isolated people, to a people that want to stay and live. They come shooting them, just like they stolen something, gold or something for the white people. They barging in, shooting in. That's the problem for Takir. His worry. That's the burden that he took to Naukotia.
They came to Gangar and shooting all the people, his people and his mother people.
They did not leave any Wangan Yulung, one person in Gangan. They just finished them off just because, just like they people at Gangan people made a trouble for white people. They came there, shot them, leave them like nothing, make them float. That's Takia's mother, their grandfather and all that. He comes from Gangan.
That's a Yulung way of looking at my uncle, Abibi, that got killed because of reason and purpose. He didn't kill for nothing. First, it was happening in here, Gangan, with his mother people tribe. And that's why this is a story, real story is.
This is Durupuchbi now, the clan homeland of Takya Wirbanda, whose story we are following in today's hindsight. His son, Wayul Wirbanda, shows us around some of the intimate ceremonial places known to Takya before he travelled to Darwin in his search for justice.
This place, this is where everything belongs to Durijabo. Durijabo is his clan, means bottom Jabo. Yo. And this is what Dagger has been. And as you stand here, and as you can see this, the pandanus tree, as you see, that is his spear. That represents his knowledge. That's why his knowledge is everything. His singing, songs, got dance, everything in that area there. Those two there, one, two. One here and one other side. This tells about two songs. One is outside and one is inside, main ceremonial. Behind that tree, this one here, you just already heard a story at Gangan. His mother tribe was shot there. And this is where their shade is. This is where they always sit, come to sit with him here in this tree here.
This square that we stand in?
This square we stand in, this would have been his burial if he would have came home here.
Yeah.
But he never turned up.
After conference with Superintendent of Police, consider it essential strong party of 12 whites, 12 Aboriginals and one cook be dispatched by end of September. Stop. strong demonstrative force imperative, as natives numerous, hostile and cunning. Stop.
When McColl was killed, the police were really angry, understandably, and Colonel Waddell, the administrator, said that he intended to send this armed party of police and special constables to Arnhem Land and that they would be suitably armed, and while he hoped that they would be able to apprehend the killers, there would inevitably be some bloodshed.
Stop. In view of past experiences, consider casualties amongst Aboriginals inevitable. But experienced leader will be instructed to guard against unnecessary killing. Stop. Colonel Robert Hunter Waddell, Administrator Northern Territory, Darwin, August 1933.
That led to absolute uproar in the southern states of Australia and indeed overseas. Groups like the Anti-Slavery Society in London came into the act. The main reason for the uproar in the southern states was that it must be remembered that this is only 5 years after the last police-organised massacre in the Northern Territory, which was at Coniston, and
the climate in the south was different for a lot of reasons. The Coniston massacre was fresh in everybody's mind. It had only taken place in 1928. There had been a royal commission, which had been a whitewash. Constable Murray was actually walking around the Northern Territory saying, "I killed people, but I didn't leave any witnesses, so I'm free." And this is in the 1930s. Australians knew that this was not acceptable. At the same time, it was a shift in thinking about the way Europeans were starting to deal with Indigenous people. In the period up until the decade of the 1920s, everyone thought Aboriginal people were disappearing. And that's how people wrote about it in the literature. They said they are gradually fading away, they are disappearing, and they used terms like that as if they were vanishing. So in the 1920s, people started to realise that Aboriginal people weren't just disappearing, because there were large, viable populations. So people are not only are people recognising that you can't, it's not just to go around slaughtering populations of people in your own country, but also that these people are here and that they're going to have to be dealt with in some way.
Northern Territory historian Mickey Dewar.
People like Elkin, the anthropologist, and the various clergy held huge meetings in Melbourne and Sydney, and the government was really pressured by the church groups and the southern do-gooders, as they were called in Darwin. The administrator's hands were very quickly tied by Canberra, and it was decided by Prime Minister Lyons that a peace party made up of Church Missionary Society personnel would go to North East Arnhem to seek to make peace. And, of course, that went down like a fart in a lift with the authorities in Darwin. They were furious that Canberra had again interfered with the running of the Northern Territory and the position of the white man.
When the government gave the go-ahead for a peace mission to be launched, then they expected the missionaries to be wiped out on this expedition. Hubert Warren, who later died in a plane crash over Bass Strait, and Elf Dyer came up as well. And he gave extraordinary interviews to the press in Melbourne and Sydney, talking about how he would go out there. He was only a small man, but he would go out there and front up to the warriors, and if he couldn't bang their heads together, or if they were showing aggression towards him, he said that he had a tin squeaker or a whistle, and he was going to distract them with that, get them laughing and get them distracted from the idea of killing him. He was a very strange character, Elf Dyer.
Guy, even though the missionaries, you should have told us straight, because you was working ahead of the government. You was working, breaking all the fights and all that, giving us plenty of taka to make us satisfied. We did not know what's been coming behind missionaries. So, we don't know. So, my blame goes back to the missionaries and the police in Darwin, in those days.
The peace mission was successful to the point where Takia and other men who'd been involved in the killing of the Japanese admitted to what they'd done, and the peace mission, the missionaries asked them or told them that we'll take you back to Darwin and you can talk to the big white government boss and tell him your side of the story. And Fred Gray took them back on his lugger with the missionaries on the understanding that they'd be talk to the administrator and tell them what had gone on.
Eventually, we get to Darwin, and that's where I had misgivings. I was almost sorry I'd taken them in. The police came down to the boat. They handcuffed the men straight away while they're on the boat. They're also reporters and all sorts of people at the time. Well, then they have to get off the boat and go up the steps of the jetty. And that was the first time that I had misgivings, because they're absolutely scared going up those steps. They were handcuffed and they had difficulty in getting used to steps because, of course, I don't think any of them had seen any steps before. Police take them away to the station, and then a little while after, I don't know who asked me to go up, whether the police came down, or a policeman came down and asked whether I would go up to the station because they had gone berserk in the cells and whether I go up and try and pacify them. So I go up and I go in the cells with them, and they tell me how the police had bashed them and knocked them about.
And their woeful keening could be heard throughout the night, and then they were dragged into court.
I was outside the court on one occasion. The court was adjourned at the time. And I saw the police tracker telling the supposed witness, Barony, what he was to say in the court. And I remember him going like this up and down with his arm, you know, telling that they must say this in the court. And that was the time, and I was really sorry that I'd brought any of them in, because I knew that Takia would have absolutely no hope at all in the court case.
The police tracker referred to is Big Pat, the same man who mysteriously directed the police party to Woodar Island the year before. The witness that Fred Gray saw him instructing was known in court as Parana, and he repeated a story almost identical to that of the police. It contrasted with the story told by the other witness, who was known variously as Makarola and Harry, the mission boy from Milangimbi. Harry's version was shortly to be lambasted by Judge Wells in his summing up to the jury.
I want you to understand quite thoroughly that although I'm making very strong statements in regard to some of the evidence, you must not take any notice of that. The story told to Harry is not only different to the story told to Parana, but it is a mighty ingenious story. If he actually invented it himself, he's not an ignorant savage, but a very cunning gentleman. We do not know whether he did invent it. But whether he did, or whether it was invented for him by someone else, you will probably have very little difficulty in coming to the conclusion that it was a sheer invention. There again, you are not compelled to accept my view. I see the real improbability of it. It is so improbable as to be incredible. One story is highly probable, the other utterly ridiculous and a fabrication. You are entitled to take into consideration that the accused has not gone into the box and told you which story is true. You can draw from it any inference you like. Harry's story is obviously ridiculous, absurd, and a fabrication. Because I have expressed strong views, you are not compelled to accept them. The onus is on the Crown to prove its case. If you accept the story told to Parana, you should bring in a verdict of guilty of murder.
Muramolar ne bargeva.
Melbourne Herald, August 7th, 1934, Darwin, Tuesday. No one has told Takiyar of death sentence yet. Nobody in court yesterday explained to him what it meant when everybody stood silent and Judge Wells ordered him to be hung. He held his wrists out for the handcuffs and walked quietly out, his face lighting up in a smile when he saw the jail motor car and realized he was to again have the thrilling experience of traveling in it. At the jail, no one could make him understand that he was under sentence of death. So, until an interpreter is taken to the jail, Takiyar will probably sleep unconcernedly, as he did all this morning.
Tom Pawling is the Solicitor General of the Northern Territory, with a long-time interest in Takiyar's trial. He's also taken on the starring role of Judge Wells in recent Law Society reenactments of the court proceedings.
Judge Wells was a man of his time, and in 1932 and 33, when these matters arose, he was very early in his career as a judge of the Supreme Court here. And it was clear that the administration and the judge and a few other people were the elite, the silvertails of Darwin. And the views he expressed early on, I think he took to be the views of the white population. I think that the idea was that rough justice was what was needed. And certainly on the summing up and the way in which he approached sentencing in this case, that is Takiyar's case, it was rough justice. Takiyar really was there in a strange place. He'd never been out of Arnhem Land before this. Sitting in an old courtroom with all these people talking a language he didn't understand a word of. So it was really a very unfair trial.
It may be that owing to the neglect or incompetence in preparation of this case by the Crown, a grave miscarriage of justice may occur.
The trial of Takiyar was brought to life at the Bali Criminal Lawyers Conference, and then later done again at the Fanny Bay Jail, where Takiyar served his time, because it underlines a number of fundamental principles about the fairness of criminal trials. And Takiyar is a bright beacon that says, whoa, look here how things, even though they seem to be in accord with popular sentiment and belief, how things can go so very badly wrong. And the High Court really were scathing in their denunciation of this trial and of the unfairness of the procedures employed in relation to Aboriginal people, particularly those who can't understand English or understand what's going on around them.
If missionaries and the Commonwealth of Knowing, if they would have been working together hand to hand, they would have saved him to take him back home. But I want to know, in my heart, I am asking, I want you, Crown, or you, missionary, give me a full detail about Takiyar Wirrpanda. He's my father. What I'm saying now, just at the present right now, I'm saying, I wish I would have been with my father in the early days. I learned something about English people and take my father out of the jail with no any disappearing. I would have been gone there, saved my father back to the family. And he would have died in our hand. He would have died in the hand. We should have made him nice funeral for him. That's why we are worried.
Look, reading the trial, any fair-minded lawyer with any experience in the way a trial is run would conclude that Takiyar had a snowball in hell's chance of getting an acquittal. And that was based on a combination of his own lawyer grossly neglecting him, betraying him, literally betraying him, the judge stitching him up for good measure just to make sure, and the prosecution, which was actually even-handed and really quite fair, and there was not that much evidence. But all of those things combined, Takiyar was going nowhere except Fanny Bay Jail for his resultant execution, which of course didn't eventuate. And the only inference really that's reasonable from all of that is that because the people that were involved in that did not want to be responsible in any way, shape or form for Turkey receiving what was the unthinkable in the context of the politics of that time, which was an acquittal.
Darwin-based barrister John Lawrence, who takes on the role of Defence Counsel Fitzgerald in the NT Law Society production of Takiyar's case.
When the when Takiyar's appeal was heard in the High Court, the judges threw out the decision against him and basically called Judge Wells' trial a travesty of justice. And Takiyar was acquitted, and it was strict instructions were sent to Darwin that Takiyar was to be escorted back to his own country. Someone must have had a premonition about what might happen. And so the word got back to Fanny Bay Jail in Darwin that Takiyar was to be freed and that he was as quickly as possible to be escorted back to his country. I think that he was freed from jail on a Tuesday, and on the Wednesday, the Reverend Alf Dyer arranged with the people at the Carlin compound. Takiyar was supposedly, he certainly was, taken from the Darwin Fanny Bay Jail to Carlin compound, which is only about a mile away, and left there because there's a photo taken of Takiyar probably on that day of his release. And then on the Wednesday, Reverend Dyer arranged with the superintendent of the compound that he would come out later that day and collect Takiyar and take him to the pictures in Darwin that night. He said, we should impress on Takiyar. You know, Dyer was a bit of an idiot. And he said, we must impress on Takiyar that there are so many white men around that he just can't go on taking liberties because the white man is here to stay and the white man is all powerful. He said, I'll take him to the pictures and he'll be able to see a lot of powerful white people and will be suitably impressed. But when Dyer went to pick up Takiyar to take him to the pictures...
And Takiyar never made it. That's the last we ever heard of him.
And there's been speculation about it ever since. Vic Hall wrote in his book that Takiyar ran away, started heading back for his country, and that Big Pat, in loyalty to his dear departed brother, Constable McColl, went after Takiyar and eventually caught him and killed him. The belief, I went to Darwin first in 1949, and I first met Fred Gray in 1953, and thereafter was asking anyone who'd been around Darwin in the 30s what they thought had happened, and almost invariably white people in Darwin said the police took Takiyar out into Darwin Harbour on that day and shot him.
He died for the people. They shot him for the people. For his own people. That his mercy for Takiyar to take all the way to the court, sitting there, no English, no one, just saying like this, somebody else have to interpret English the wrong way and making him disappear. Okay? Making him disappear. That's Taruk. I'm talking strongly because I am the last family and the son of Takiyar. If he broke one little law inside the jail, I want them to tell us. I want information from them. Let us know. Because it is true, out of my heart, out of my knowledge, comes out whatever I do. Give me reminds back to Takiyar. I should be with my father. I should be with my father. Just because he left half of his knowledge for us. He left half of the knowledge for us. The full knowledge was taken to Darwin and was disappeared. That's all. Now that's what I'm looking at, and my family looking at. You know, we are looking at very strongly, finding where he is. You know, some people say they shot him near railway line in Darwin. Some people say they shot him and buried him there. Some people are saying that he was carried away to the wharf, Darwin Wharf, and thrown into the sea, which make me and my family very upset. Throwing men like him, throwing men, strong leader like him, honest leader like him, throwing him to the fish, throwing him like a dog, throwing him like a cow or something, for the crocodile, for the rock cod to eat him up. Full black Yolngu, which make our culture strong.
We've been waiting until today, still waiting. We heard lots of story about my uncle. I don't know, where is he? Who killed him? What his you people have been doing to my uncle, Abibi? I'd like to know about a story from you, your mouth, your heart, your opinion, your way of looking at it. I want to know, where is he? Where is he? In the air, on the water, sea, or in the mud? Where is he? I want to know from you people, so I can tell my people in here, Gangan Durpujpi and Ilpara. We are not happy. We are not satisfied about books, story, books, when you are writing in the books, that's telling a lie, covering yourself. I want to know about the truth story.
So please, we want our father back. And so please tell us the truth where you buried him. Moro rajare Moro rajare Om Dagalmae Om Reading Lama Gragwan Meraya.
Dakiyar vs. the King was presented and produced by Tom Murray, and the sound engineer was Judy Rapley. Thanks to the family of Dakiyar Wirrupanda, to all those at Yilpra, Gangan and Durupuchipi, to Leon White and to the late Andrew McMillan. Hindsight is back on your radio next Sunday at 1. I'm Lorena Allam. My thanks today to Lila Schunner. The news is next, here on RN.